Yeah, thank you, Maya, and the center. And I want to start by thanking the spirits that have allowed us to gather here tonight and honoring each and every one of your spirits for being here. So thank you. I'm going to start by defining a couple of terminologies and then proceed to explain a little bit of how I became a doula, followed by giving a snapshot of midwifery care and obstetrical care in Quebec, and then kind of wrapping it up with what that actually means for bodies of color, specifically black bodies here in Canada. So why did I choose to spell woman W-O-M-B-N instead of W-O-M-A-N? For me, woman, W-O-M-B-N, is a term that I coined because I wanted something that represents the experience of all individuals, regardless of their gender representation. And when I thought of that, it comes back to the womb. That's kind of where we emerge from. And if someone chooses to use that and for reproductive purposes, it doesn't make sense more concretely for me to refer to a trans man carrying a child as a woman, W-O-M-A-N. And whereas W-O-M-B-N is a little bit more inclusive. I'm still trying to figure out how to articulate all of this. I would love to hear some of your thoughts later on of how you grapple with some of these concepts and having these conversations verbally as well as in written format. So does that clarify a little bit? Okay. Obviously, when I speak, it kind of all sounds the same. but bear in mind, I am referring to W-O-M-B-N, so that it's inclusive of everyone. And the other term is reproductive justice. Maya spoke a little bit about it. So for me, using woman is an expansion of what reproductive justice is about, which is what Sister Song have initiated. And I'll highlight how they describe reproductive justice. Reproductive justice emerged as an intersectional theory highlighting the lived experiences of reproductive oppression in communities of color. It represents a shift from women advocating for control of their bodies from a narrower focus on legal access and individual choice, which is the focus of mainstream organization, to a broader analysis of racial, economic, cultural, and structural constraints on our power. And so that's kind of what reproductive justice is. Is it clear? Like it goes a lot more in detail, but basically that's a snapshot that we need to go beyond individual choices. I often get this question, where did I get my doula training from? It comes on a regular basis. Is everyone clear on what a doula is or does? Yeah? No? I won't go into much details at this point, but basically, it's what is important to me anyway, is to hold a space sacred and for the families during prenatal, at the birth, and postpartum care, as well as advocating for the rights of the family. But I'll go into details later on, but it's kind of like minus the clinical aspect and more of the spiritual element of the work. That's how I practice it. So the question, where did you get your doula training from, is problematic to me. And I'll explain a little bit why it's problematic. But first, I'm going to tell you how I did end up getting my doula training. And it's as simple as the good old-fashioned way, by watching my mother organize with other women of the Ethiopian Jewish community, with the Women's Committee, on a regular basis. That's the fundamental way where I saw what nurturing is really about and preventative care. And I saw them act around taking care of the woman and the children. The man and the role of the husband is kind of not so much, but primarily it was about the mother and her children. But that was just like one aspect of my learning process. This the other aspect where I developed my consciousness around birthing issues in North America is through the work that I did with the Brown Birthing Network and by assisting conferences with the Black healers and midwives in the United States. And that's where I got a better understanding of what it actually means to be having Black babies here in North America, which is very different than my mother and the other Ethiopian woman who speaks of traditions and ways of doing it back home, but practicing here in Montreal. So that was the second aspect of the training. And which still is not enough. And specifically with regards to challenging heteronormative expressions. And that came out of my activism as a student at McGill University with the Black Students Network and the Africana Studies Committee. And it's taken all of that and having two kids to get a little bit of an understanding of what it means to nurture and take care and advocate and honor having children. So for me, the question, where did I get my doula training, is I did not go to a doula school to get my training. There are a lot of schools out here who provide training, but in the way that I needed, the one that incorporates that takes into account the history of slavery and colonialism, and that's relevant to the communities that I'm serving, and that speaks to me, to my culture, to my children, and to my mothering practices, I had to do it on my own. And for me, that's what makes sense. But the reason why I do find that problematic being asked that question, because it is asking of me to be legitimate and respectable. It feels similar to kind of the yoga studios. You go in and the space kind of feels a little bit awkward because you're not wearing the right outfit. So it's asking me to explain who I am, as opposed to this is what I come with. And I don't need to be legitimate. I don't need to be respectable. I just need to be me. The same way as I would treat my clients, I just need them to be them. So, I would love to hear what's some of the experiences of some of the doulas later on around this issue of the training and what comes about with that. There's a group of doulas in Quebec who are trying to trying to formalize and regulate doula work, and so that the work that we do, because right now it's private. It could be accessible, and eventually if the government covers it, then it's universal care for anyone who just wants doula services. But which is interesting and sounds okay in theory, but if we're to examine what happened with the midwifery movement when they became legal in 1999, it just gives us an idea of what are some of the pitfalls waiting for us when we're asking the state to intervene in our reproductive process. And last summer when I participated at UNIFEST, which is a gathering of about 400 birth workers, primarily midwives in Quebec, I saw maybe in one hand the number of Black people, and this out of 400, and the issues around touching the Black communities were not put in the agenda, and it represents what the birthing world is here. Those who have access to midwifery services are primarily white women, educated, and a comfortable economic status. But in speaking to some of the elder midwives, they said the reason why they made the law before the legalization of midwifery care and midwifery services is so that all women will have access. But not all women have access to midwifery services. And by default, those who have to go and have and use hospital services are women of color, and just anyone who's not, I guess, essentially like affluent, white, educated, which is a good part of the population. So birth workers in Quebec and across North America have a way of presenting a utopian image of birthing that is universal to all women, and it is not the case. It's similar to how a critique of the feminist movement portraying itself as representing the experiences and the needs of all women, whereas it just represents, you know, a certain class of white women and their needs. So yes, birthing is theoretically a universal experience, but in practice it's not. And definitely it's not if you're a black body out of here. Those are the things that kind of sit in my head as the services of midwives increasingly become professionalized, regulated, integrated into mainstream as a viable birthing option. It is important to just pause and reflect what that actually means and look at some of the structural barriers that are present in their practice, as well as the individual barriers that midwives come with. Just because they're midwives, they're not any different than you and I and other members of the society. They come with baggage. And so who gets to be called a midwife here? It's a 4.5 years program. It's a bachelor's of midwifery and only available in French. So that's the start. And take a guess of how many people are accepted in the program every year. Any wild numbers?
20. 60.
Okay. Good. About 18. 18 to 20.
Wow.
On a good year. And how many graduate at the end? like in 2013, there were like maybe 15 graduates. Yeah. And if you're an international, if you study midwifery or practice midwifery outside of here, can you just become a midwife? You must know the French culture to be able to articulate and answer the questions that you're being asked, but it also requires a 30-credit sort of certificate. So it doesn't matter if you have 20 years of experience and know a lot more than what the midwives here know. It's still like if you don't know the game, you cannot become a midwife. So it's not skill based. It's not knowledgeable, and it's not. It's really, can you fit the criteria? And how many black midwives are there? I don't know any. I'm hoping every time I ask this question, I'm hoping someone else does. No. I've worked with a couple of North African midwives. I think one Lebanese as well, but I haven't come across any black midwives. And I had my first child in 2002, just right after it became legal and midwives were still working out the kinks. So it's been a while. It's like they've had time. They've had time to just identify, even if it's a problem, and then put actions in place. So this is kind of I guess the idea. But students are encouraged to go do their internship in Africa. Do you think there are any courses around critical race theory, a history on slavery, colonialism, that the students, that is part of the program? No. So I'll give you, I was speaking to a fourth year student, and just she just had some questions, and I gave her an update of, you know, the some of the racial issues, and she sent me this email, and it says, it's in French, so I'm going to read it in French and make translate it after. So she's white, lesbian, and planning on doing her internships in Africa. Again, broad Africa, no country, no nothing. Africa. So she writes to me. Nos échanges m'ouvrent à une réalité qui m'était peu connue. J'étais dans l'innocence de ces phénomènes raciaux qui semblent bien forts et ancrés dans notre système. So basically, she just felt very naive and innocent and not having known any of the issues surrounding. I guess it's just like, I think it's just basic university education, you know, but it's not required of the students. It's just problematic on so many levels how they could be encouraged to do their internships all around the world and have no references or accountability to the population that they serve here. So it's okay to go study us, take our ideas, take our children, but nothing to do with the community that's here. And so for me, that's a major problem. You can't do it both ways. Like there's an accountability process that's not in place. And I asked her if she's read the book by Cheryl Nessel, which is a book that explores the implicit and explicit forms of racism in midwifery in Ontario. First of all, there's very, very little information about this. About racism in Canada and midwifery, like we don't have that information. No one's really collecting the data. So the fact that Cheryl had this book and that's widely available for quite a few years, I thought that she may have had to do it as part of her reading, and she's never heard of it. She went to inquire in her school library, and they didn't have it. So they had to do a special order, and this is just a basic understanding of midwifery in Canada. And it's so it just shows you how much work needs to be done to be able to just like as a process of accountability and being present here and respond to the needs of the population. So so where am I? So just to wrap up, who gets to be called a midwife? And on a side note, it's illegal for someone to refer to themselves, correct me if I'm wrong, Rivka, but if for someone to refer to themselves as a midwife if they're not part of the Order of Midwife in Quebec. And this is punishable by law. So we have some underground midwives who do the work because part of the professionalization of the service and part of the regulating body is that they have to follow certain protocols, and which may be in conflict with the traditional way of traditional models of midwifery care or holistic care, which is really about following the leads of the woman and the child. So just follow nature, respond. But once you become a body that's regulated, then you have to follow all these protocols. And if you see someone who is not following those protocols, you are obligated as a midwife to report them. And so it puts us, I know some of the midwives in difficult situations because they see some of their sisters kind of following in spite of the regulation, just letting nature take its course. But for others who don't come out of that tradition, who are just doing the education and not, but they might be inclined to report if they see that. So it is a concern. So although birthing with midwife has shown to yield better health outcomes compared to birthing with obstetricians, families continue to experience institutionalized racism, and I'm calling midwives to examine how their practice partake in perpetuating systemic racism, both personally and as a sector. Without strategic policies that take into account the specific needs of the Black communities, those who will continue to have access to and benefit from midwifery care will be educated, white, affluent, traditionally structured families. The rest will be birthing in hospitals subjected to the cycle of obstetrical care. And I'm going to tell you a little story of what that cycle looks like. Okay. So this is a story of Dominic and Jade. They're a queer Black couple having a baby at their local hospital. Dominic is a masculine identified woman. Jade arrives at the hospital and after an hour starts feeling that she isn't performing according to schedule. She and Dominic are told by the hospital staff that they know what is best for their child, all the while ignoring that Jade is the one who has been safely carrying the child for 10 months. At the initial stage of labor, the staff alluded to letting nature take its course, but they made sure to remind them, remember, nature can be dangerous. You have to be careful, but we're here for you. With every health professional entering the birthing room, Jade is reminded of who really is in charge of the well-being of her child. The financially well-off educated professional, the machines, the masculine partner who can be trusted to provide traditional rational responses. Yes, because women do go mad during labor, right? And all hormonals, with their judgments, it's common knowledge. And every clocked entrance to the room reminds Jade that she isn't performing well because she hasn't delivered the product yet. She's aware that she is failing to perform her part while everyone else is doing theirs. There must be something wrong with her machinery. Pitocin, a synthetic drug to induce contraction, is given. Finally, there's some action. The contractions are coming, fast and intense. The woman's trying to ride the wave, but she can't handle the pain. She can hear the professionals talking to Dominique. Didn't we tell you that there was something wrong with her? Of course she can't have a baby on her own, she needs us. Let's give her some epidural to ease the pain. Dominique, why don't you talk to her? Jade, sweetheart, sorry, but because you don't have Canadian health coverage, you have to pay the anesthesiologist first. Otherwise, you're going to have to tolerate the pain, and we know that you can't do that anymore. The nurse interjects, why don't you ask your people to lend you the $800? And your companion can collect it. Dominic saves the day by taking the cash that was put aside for the rent. Jade gets a bit of relief from the pain and dozes off. She wakes up to mind-numbing pain from her right side. The epidural wasn't administered properly. She must tolerate the pain. What happened to the contractions? Why are they less frequent? She murmurs under her breath, shit. I forgot that they said that this was going to be one of the side effects. Things were going to slow down. The nurse comes in. Sorry, hon. We must increase the Pitocin to stimulate more contractions because you're not progressing in the way that we need you to. Jade tries to tolerate the pain, but the pain resulting from synthetic drug is significantly more painful than normal contractions, and it's coming fast. Suddenly, the monitor starts beeping. Beep, 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 beep. What's going on? The doctor says, your baby's in distress and can't handle the contractions. We have to prep the OR. We're taking you in for surgery. You're having emergency cesarean. As she is being cut, she can feel the pain. Remember, the anesthesiologist didn't do the job properly? And she can feel her baby being pulled out of her womb. She doesn't see her baby for another hour and a half. As she goes in and out of a drugged state, she wonders, where's my baby at? Fast forward 2 hours. She tries to nurse her baby because she's been told that breast is fed best, yet the baby isn't cooperating. She obviously doesn't know what she's doing. Why is the baby drowsy? Why are the baby's reflexes so slow? Why isn't the baby latching? Can I please get some help? Fast forward 8 hours. She finds herself squeezing the colostrum into a spoon to feed the baby. She is tired and her body hurts. 20 hours later. Baby is still not latching at the breast. She calls her friend, Emmanuel, who had chest fed his baby, for advice. He tells her that he had similar issues when he gave birth and that it's normal for the baby to be slow and that it's a consequence of the drugs that were given to her at birth. During labor, sorry. And to expect a delay for a few days before her milk can come in. 32 hours later, the resident comes in and tells Dominique that she needs to supplement with formula because the baby's losing too much weight. Jade is crying, completely discouraged. She can't seem to do anything right. When they go home, Jade saw that her mother, wanting to be supportive, had bought a 1 month supply of formula using the coupon that she received from Nestle in the mail. Fast forward 72 hours. Jade tries to breastfeed, but she is so tired and her nipples hurt. Her partner offers to give the baby the bottle while she gets 6 straight hours of sleep. Fast forward 96 hours. Emmanuel comes to visit and notices that one of Jade's nipples is cracked. He tells her that she should see a lactation consultant, but Jade doesn't have the money to pay for private services. 3 weeks later, she gave up on breastfeeding. It was too hard. And she just didn't have enough milk. 4 weeks later, baby is still complaining of sharp pain in the stomach. The baby has an intolerance to milk protein in the formula. The family now has to buy expensive specialized formula. The rent is now 2 months behind. Fast forward a year. The baby keeps on getting ear infections. The antibiotics are not helping. 2 years later, toddler needs to have surgery to remove fluids from the ear. 11 years later, gym teacher notices that the child is wheezing in class. Child has asthma. 18 years later, congratulations on becoming an adult. I'm sorry to inform you that you are severely overweight and diabetic. So, this is what a cycle feels like. No one had any intention of this happening going in. But this is what leads one thing to another. And this is just, what I gave you is really just the bare bones. There are other horror stories with more interventions and so forth. And there's a place for necessary intervention and there's unnecessary medical interventions. And the reality is the unnecessary medical interventions are made at a higher rate with black women and women of color than with white women. And it's just one thing after another, after another, after another. And it's not something that you just say it's in your face. This is it, like this is why this person's doing this. It requires a level of consciousness and education to be able to recognize what's going on and the cause. And the good news with the story that I told you is most of it could be prevented. So I'm gonna share with you a few ways that those things could have been prevented. At 40 weeks, is it necessary to induce labor? So it's possible to wait. And here the leeway is you can wait up to 42 weeks. The reason I'm convinced that so much is done is that the woman feels pressure to produce. And so it's not because the body's ready, it's not because the baby's ready, but the external factors that can, like all the phone calls from well-meaning, intentional people saying like, is the baby here? Is the baby here? So at 40 weeks, it's like if the baby's not there, then got to do something because everyone around is saying, is the baby here? And then when you go to the hospital, it's just like, you could, you know, induce, you should have the baby out. It's the weekend. I got if I'm the doctor on call, I don't really want to come on the, like if it's an induction, I have an idea of when the baby's gonna be born. It's manageable. So by reducing that pressure to produce, which is a reflection of the society that we live in, then that gives a little bit more leeway. Obviously, there are medical reasons when, like, this is where the midwives and the obstetrician evaluate, is it necessary to induce? And there are natural ways of doing it also to help the process, but it's not because it's 40 weeks. First of all, it's very difficult to know when the conception time is, so it's off. We're off with our times. It requires a holistic judgment. Sorry. It's not about nature taking its care, nature taking its course, but what's convenient. So those are like, what day of the week, what time, is that at the end of the shift, am I gonna get paid for it, I'm not, if my colleague is gonna take over the case. So there's all these considerations. And the other way that the scenario that I described could have been prevented is just by leaving the woman alone. Studies have shown over and over, when you leave the woman alone, nature just has a way of working out, because the woman goes inwards and is able to just connect and move along with the process in a lot smoother way. It doesn't mean it will be pain-free, far from it, but it will be a lot more manageable. And then there's the skin-to-skin contact. It is recommended and shown over and over that the first hour makes a big difference, skin-to-skin. And I'll give you a quote by Dr. Phillips explaining skin to skin and why it's important. So being skin to skin with mothers protects the newborn from the well-documented negative effects of separation, support optimal brain development, and facilitate attachment, which promotes the infant's self-regulation over time. Normal babies are born with the instinctive skill and motivation to breastfeed and are able to find the breast and self-attach without assistance when skin to skin is done. So just remember that anything outside of the womb for a baby, it's a very hostile environment. So if you put the baby right away, then you're already easing the transition. And this is a transition, like when we think about it, so all those weighing the baby, cleaning the baby, all of that, they could wait. But for the first hour, leave them alone. You know how is it like with one of the preventative stuff for during labor? If you leave the woman alone, nature takes care of it. Well, leave the baby alone. Leave the family alone. It's a very simple and yet very difficult thing to do. It asks that the ego be removed from the scene. And most people, it's very difficult. It's just society tells us we gotta be busy, we gotta do something, we gotta produce. What happens when we just sit still and do nothing? And so that's kind of where for me the foundation of the practice is, what happens when we just sit there and just hold the space sacred for nature to take its course, because it does. So with everything that I've described, is it possible to have mystical birthing experience if you're a Black woman? That is rooted in the question of understanding what the experience of being Black is in this continent. And it's a very violent experience. It's having to deal with the racism and the legacy of all this violence over and over. And in order to be able to experience that mystical experience, you need to feel safe to a certain extent. And where is the safety in having a child and opening up myself up to a midwife who is racist or who is ignorant and is making racist comments, or to the doctor? Where is the safety in being in that hospital where everything and the society as a whole is telling me I shouldn't be here. And where's the safety in bringing into this world a black child that I know is already going to be dehumanized as soon as his head is out of my womb? How can I, knowingly all of that, allow myself to experience this out-of-body experience of being connected to the universe, knowing that my child is going to be harmed? Regardless of who he is, what he does, what he looks like, just because he is black. And that's the work. That's where the real work has to be done. It's, yes, there's structural issues and so forth, but how do you make this place safe for a black being? And no one is talking about that. There's none of that in the curriculum. And all the other stuff, they're just band-aid solutions. So I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just like, of course. But it requires a conscious understanding of working with the family and allowing an attachment parenting, a model of just letting go. Letting go to the idea that your child will be harmed. And your child will, as a black body, just at the spiritual level, at the physical level, is going to be in harm's way and will be dehumanized as soon as that child is out of your womb. So that's the real worker for that's the work for the birth workers. That's the work for me as a doula. And that's how you break violence, the cycle of violence. And why it's okay to just like, it's okay to love your child by letting that child go. For a black woman, having a child is not about the birth experience. It's about the existence of the black body. It's about the pregnancy. It's about raising that child. It's not separate. There isn't that privilege of just making it about the birth, because the birth is not disconnected from the reality of being black in the society. For maybe a white woman that's just very individual can focus on that, just being the birth. But for a black woman, it's not. And I'm not saying that they're all conscious of it, but at the subconscious level, when you're thinking about your having a child, it's not about the birth. It's like, what does it mean to raise a child lovingly and safely? And that's what sits in the back of the mind. And that's where the real work is. And the part of the letting go, both attachment, letting go is accepting you do, but you can't also. Like that you're interacting with the world and there's a risk that comes with it. And accepting that part of that risk is your child will be killed. And that killing is not at the physical level, it's at the spiritual level. And that's what all birth workers have to be conscious of. Whether they're doulas, midwives, doctors, nurses, that's how you gotta communicate. That's what's gonna help long-term the family. Letting go of that, and then being in that mystical place that exists. Because it exists. And it comes from love. And acting from a place of love. And I'm going to end by reading you something that I wrote in the summer that kind of captures why I do birth work and my role as a mother. And it goes, I wondered over the summer, how do I honor my calling of practicing traditional midwifery as a single mom without destabilizing the routine and structure that my child craves? How can I sustain myself financially when my priority is to make sure that my child is mentally, spiritually sound and thriving? When I am present at a birth, everything makes sense. Head out in the world, body still in the womb, everything is should be. Nurtured, sheltered, one. Nothing to do but wait. Wait for the keys of the baby, the wisest person in the room. There is stillness, 2 minutes of peace, awe, connectedness, inner standings of life. I kneel at the feet of mom and baby and I bathe in their love. Circumstances have limited my presence to only 2 births this year. I yearn for those moments of alignment with the universe when I am bathed in the light of love. Vibrating mystical connections, flickers of mysticism continue, and bittersweet moments. His lack of impulse control isn't all for the bad. You see, when he feels intense love for me, he can't control the urge to kiss me, hug me, and to tell me, I love you, mommy. Left unchallenged, but to be himself, without labels, he connects to his high powers of love, experiencing snapshots in time where it is enough to be him, just him. Not the problem child, not the violent kid, not the annoying one, not the one who doesn't get it, not the one who has to explain why he's a grade behind even though he's brilliant, not the one who has to carry the shame of feeling like a dummy, underperforming no matter how hard he tries, needing additional help, not understanding. He has to explain his existence to his peers, only to be denied. Damien said that if I am 7, I have to be in grade 2. He said I'm not 7 years old. I am a dummy because I am 8 and in grade 2. He feels injustice, so he speaks up. Mommy, why won't they let me eat injera at school with my hands? But I'm Ethiopian, is that prejudice? Mommy, Sarah said that she didn't want to play with me at recess because she already played with one black kid today. Was she being racist? But that's not nice. Mommy, how come grandma and grandma don't want to talk to you because you date women? That's not fair. Mommy, why are you in the moon? Pourquoi tu es dans la lune? Was daddy ever violent with you? He asks, not knowing that I dissociate because I'm forced to interact with my aggressor. He feels, without being able to articulate in words, the injustices around him. He listens to what is not spoken out loud. He watches faces because of the truth in the gaze. He grabs to feel grounded. He asks until he gets an answer that resonates with him. He demands authentic connections. When he loves me, it is because he experiences in the present traces of that mystical dust from birth. Because he feels he is enough. Because he sees that I see him, all of him. Because he feels heard. Because he feels safe with me. Because he feels so much love that he doesn't know how to contain it. Because he feels accomplished. Because he experienced success. Because when he is angry and doesn't know what to do with himself, demonstrating his love to me is still the strongest grounding force. As he navigated the birth canal and the intense contractions, he navigates this world, feeling its ailments. When moments of love and light are one, he radiates, and I partake in his glow. I feel the rays in his smile and the brightness of his eyes. The heat of his body through the softness of his limbs bring me in. He's experiencing love and I find stillness in the universe again. The go-to place where everything makes sense and I allow myself to breathe in, breathe out. I know the moment when his head is exposed to the world and his body resting in my womb, protected and nurtured, is brief. For now, I allow myself to bathe in his light and follow his cues because he remains the wisest person in the room.